welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as you can probably tell, we've been dealing with content at a pretty fast clip. Because now I'm starting to cover content on Mondays and Fridays, and now on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, we're covering content with my guest. Welcome back, Tammy Young, out of Wyoming. She is a Republican extraordinaire and the chair of the Republican, or I should say, the Republic Review Committee, and yes. So. And an upcoming, the convention is beginning of May, right? For the reorg?
Yes. May 2nd.
Okay.
May 3rd, yep.
Yep, there you go, folks. And so there will be a shift in the I guess the magnetic poles of the earth. as Frank Ethorn has kind of put his hat out there and said, I'm not going to be hanging my hat on the party for the next couple of years. He's taking a break. And he's done more good in Wyoming than I've seen anything close in any other state. And that's what happens when you have a good leader leading the party. And so we hope and pray that, his predecessor can put him to shame.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let's hope.
Anyway, so as I say, as we appeal to heaven, learn, pray, act, and as a matter of fact, this campaign that we're trying to use in holding people accountable is something that the Department of Justice should be doing, but this is something we need to do so that in the upcoming election, either this year or at least next year, and when I say next year, 2026 will be an election year where most county commissioners or supervisors will, half of them at least, if I understand this correctly, half of them will be up for re-election. We've got to start getting rid of these guys, our gals, people. Anyway, political correctness just kills me. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and move forward. Folks, we were diving through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and we've been really focused on, one, admitting states into the Union, and the other thing is we've been focused on property, representation, fundamentals of Republican government, which is, again, representation, apportionment is the same thing, and the taxation, property, how to do all of that, because one of the things that they realized with the Articles of Confederation is that they couldn't fund the general government. The states weren't paying their bill. And they said, we need to have coercive capabilities to be able to come in and actually hold people accountable to their obligations in supporting these things that we have to do that the Constitution requires us to do. You're going to empower us. You're going to give us these powers. You're going to give us these responsibilities, these enumerations. And one of them has to be our ability to say, you got to pay for this. Like we're going to war or we're doing a census so that we can update the apportionment and representation. So anyway, with that, let's go ahead and dive into what Madison was offering, because we just heard from, I think, was it Governor Morris? No, it was Colonel Mason.
Colonel Mason.
Yeah, Colonel Mason. Okay, so go ahead. Let's start there.
Hey, Mr. Madison, the right of suffrage is certainly one of the fundamental articles of Republican government and ought not to be left to be regulated by the legislature. A gradual abridgment of this right has been the mode in which aristocracies have been built on the ruins of popular forms.
Okay, hold on here. I want to expound upon what you just read. Okay. The right of suffrage. Now, in a Republican form of government, we get representation. And the whole point of having representation is to give the people their suffrage in these different venues and under our umbrella of republicanism or under this new design, the people, we have our suffrage in the House of Representatives at the federal level, and the state legislatures have their representation. So Madison points out that ought not to be left to be regulated by the legislature. Now, we've talked about what legislature is he talking about? He's talking about the national legislature. We've already pointed out that they've actually used that, you know, national legislature. When they're just talking general terms, we kind of all look at, okay, who are they talking about? And in this particular case, they want to make sure that they don't create or don't allow the legislature, the national legislature, to be able to start taking control and regulating how representation is going to be done. Right. Which basically, that's why they forged and pounded out a hard fixed number of 40,000. And then the last minute, they reduced it to 30,000 to ensure that the legislature did not basically move down this path of increasing the amount of people that they represent to where they actually establish an aristocracy. There's a class of people because, you know, they represent so many people that, you know, they can't be bothered with what everybody needs. They just have to be benevolent and be the beneficent prince. These are levels of monarchy that we actually see where the president's the king and the people in Congress are different forms of whether they be dukes or princes. And I would look at the Senate as more of a prince and the representatives more of like dukes and counts and barons or whatever. And so this is why he actually went out to this and said, a gradual abridgment of this right has been the mode in which aristocracies have been built on the ruins of popular forms. And so keep going from there now.
Whether the constitutional qualification ought to be a freehold would with him depend much on the probable reception such a change would meet within. States where the right was now exercised by every description of people, in several of the states, freehold was now the qualification. Viewing this subject in its merits alone, the freeholders of the country would be the safest depositories of Republican liberty.
Okay, what he just said is to have freeholders, it would be the safest repository to basically be able to, you know, maintain these standards and so forth, because freeholders, people that own land, actually have skin in the game.
Yeah.
Okay. So keep going from there. Thanks.
In future times, a great majority of the people will not only be without landed, but any other sort of property. These will either combine under the influence of their common situation, in which case the rights of property and the public liberty will not be secure in their hands. Or which is more probable, they will become the tools of opulence and ambition, in which case there will be equal danger on another side. The example of England had been misconceived by Colonel Mason. A very small proportion of the representatives are there chosen by freeholders. The greatest part are chosen by the cities and bureaus, and many of which the qualifications of suffrage is as low as it in any of the U.S. It was in the boroughs of cities rather than the counties that liberty most prevailed and the influence of the crown on elections was most dangerously exerted.
Okay, so obviously he made point of a few things here, and he pointed out that, and in a previous, if you remember the last episode or last content we did last week, Madison spoke up and said, now, look, you know, we've got these people that are agrarian landholders, but that doesn't mean that, you know, that is the end all of apportionment, representation, and affluence in America. you know, surely you have people that own land with the agrarians, but what about the these other market spaces of, you know, making prominence or making, you know, amassing influence and affluence? And those things being, I believe, the mercantile system as well as the industrial system. In other words, manufacturing and or mercantile, making, you know, fine goods, appliances, tables, chairs, that type of stuff, or, you know, manufacturing, mass producing things through a factory. And so as we kind of look, and things started, you know, migrating more and more to where people were selling stuff that was becoming more, I'll just say, opulent. And he even talks about this in the, right here, where he actually points out this concept of opulence and or ambition, that these become the tools of the legislature. And so they're going to find that the people that can get rich quick are usually manufacturing and industrial and those types of things. If you can create something that everybody wants, then all of a sudden you've just made a flash amount of money, because you'll get the orders, the, you know, down payments or what have you, where farmers, they have to wait for that crop and then they have to take it to market and sell it and so forth. So the point here is, you know, and you look at what he said previously, that America is going to be going down these different paths where we're no longer going to be an agrarian society. As we move more to the West, there may be more ranching. There may be more hunting and trapping. There may be, you know, other types of markets that will come up, and even our factories. And so America was at the beginning, or it was at the, it's at the cradle of change. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, over the next half century, things were going to be introduced in America that nobody would fathom, such as railroads and steamboats and other mechanisms of being able to move commerce more efficiently. And so he's trying to make sure that we have these things, and that's why he starts this off, that the fundamental articles of a Republican government ought not to be left by the legislature. And I think he was pointing to the fact that it needed to, because it had been brought up a few times by other people, it needed to be hard-coded into the Constitution where it would require an amendment to change that. If you allow them to just whimsically change it, they will start watering down the people's control as well as the Senate's control and so forth. And so when we look, or I should say the state legislature's control over the Senate. So this is what he's really trying to bring out and trying to point out, that when you look at in this very last part where he starts talking about cities and boroughs, he said the qualification of suffrage is as low as it is in any part of the United States. And the boroughs and the cities, rather than the counties, are more susceptible to bribery. So, anyway, as he's throwing all of these things out, it wasn't an coming up with the Constitution was not an easy task at all. And to kind of, you know, go through what we need to do. I look at today where people want to jump into an Article 5 convention, or even there are people that are trying to push for, just without learning, without understanding the importances of constitutions, the principles of a Republican government, these types of things, which are fundamental, because people don't understand these today. We need to start, and the best way to cut our teeth is to actually start having constitutional conventions at the county level. That's where everybody's going to cut their teeth, and they're going to start realizing what real powers, because we have to have, we the people have to have these open conversations of what we want government to do in serving us. And we're going to find that there'll be some that want them to take care of everything from wiping their butts to, you know, doing their shopping, you know, whatever. They just don't want to be responsible for themselves. But we're going to find that that's going to be very rare and few in these darker red counties. And as a matter of fact, when people really start putting some of these ideas that may seem good, we've talked about this, right? Remember, we talked about throwing ideas at the wall, and if it stuck, you know, it didn't just slide down the wall quickly, then, you know, it was a better idea than the other ideas that slid down the wall quickly. And what will end up happening is we'll start seeing, and people will start learning the providence in actually having an open conversation and defending ideas. Can you imagine, though, you know, the sufferings that people will have to go through to actually, you know, put an idea out there and then people reject it? I mean, shoot. I see people, you know, trying to control, like Karens, and I hate using that term, but there are people that are so emotionally driven that they're going to make the biggest mistakes, and they don't care because their emotions possess them. Mm-hmm. And we're going to deal with that. We're going to have to deal with that because we've enabled these types of paradigms, this entitlement within people. I mean, how long was it? It was over a week ago when the Democrats went out and basically protested, you know, the Trump and what Trump's doing. And I forget. Do you remember what they were all about? Holding, staying out of our Social Security, you get out of our, you know, entitlements.
Oh yeah,
that type of stuff. Yeah, and I'm going. Pardon me. Go ahead.
He's going to take away Social Security and nobody, yeah.
Well, so that would never happen. That would be, I honestly, unless you actually have a plan that would deal with Social Security properly, in other words, we have to end it. But people hear that and they think, okay, that means I'm not going to get paid. And I was promised this. No, that doesn't mean that. We have to end it and actualize it at the same time. And so we have, until we have the big britches conversations, right, where the real adults come into the room and actually start talking about things. Because if you want to act like a Karen, or if you want to act like an emotionally driven person, a drama queen, how about that? If you want to act like a drama queen, then maybe you shouldn't be in that room because you're not going to be helpful at all. But people who are objective and people who are willing to listen to the ideas and realize that their ideas stink and that they need to work on improving their ideas and actually start listening to, because brilliance will come forth. And the most important part of the process, just like here at the Constitutional Convention, the reason why the Articles of Confederation sucked is because they didn't humble themselves on a daily basis before the divine hand, before the Creator, and say, please bless us with providence, bless us with insights, so that we can resolve these problems for this nation. Having an invocation on a regular basis and inviting His divine wisdom is the key to, you know, making things actually happen. Because when people do that, they tend to, you know, I'll just say, put on, you know, the objectivity and the rational thought, and they tend to take off the garments of contention. And instead of being just the contrarian, you know, you may have that contrarian out there. As a matter of fact, a lot of people like to call me the contrarian because, you know, I have criticisms towards lots of different ideas. And that doesn't mean I'm right, but it definitely doesn't mean I'm wrong. So the point is that we have to develop thicker skin. We have to actually start listening. And then we actually have to start recognizing what are the things we really need to overcome, you know, with everybody in the room, because that's what we need. And that's one of the reasons why, when we start picking representation at the county level for these committees, for, you know, these constitutional conventions and so forth, folks, you need to help everybody you know, go through the 101 basics of representation so that people know what to look for. Don't be getting people that are driven. Don't select a person that's driven by their emotions. Get somebody that is well-educated and objective and willing to actually listen to all the ideas and try to make everything happen properly. The key thing is that the no constitution, no county constitution, can create a violent objection or a conflict with the U.S. Constitution. Ergo, we can't allow the county constitution to say you can't have guns, you can't bear arms. Or we can't allow the concept of, you know, freedom of religious expression. You know, no, we're just going to be this religion and these other religions, you're out. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because things changed with the evolution of the Constitution and the amendments as it started expanding the protections for we the people. So anyway, as we kind of look again, Madison was really focused in this comeback regarding how England and Britain, because he used the term aristocracy. When one looks at the House of Lords, that is nothing but an aristocracy. When one looks at the Senate, and based on its design, it was an aristocracy. It was an elite group of people chosen by the state legislatures to represent the states in the U.S. Senate. Then, all of a sudden, we got this thing that's, you know, kind of popped up where the House of Representatives required, you know, more and more people to, you know, to be represented by one person. In other words, they started watering it down. And now the House of Representatives has become an aristocracy. There's no way, you know, some of these people would continually get elected if they actually, you know, had to get only 30,000 votes. Because you'd find that with 30,000, Nancy Pelosi would probably have a much harder time to go and, you know, being elected. And even so, you know, her influence would be watered down significantly because instead of it being one out of 400, she would be one out of thousands. And she would not be able to amass that type of power. Let's go into what Dr. Franklin has to say. We got actually a minute and a half. And so, can you do this? You know what? Let's just read the first couple lines. Let's go ahead and start off that way.
It is of great consequence that we should not depress the virtue and public spirit of our common people, of which they displayed a great deal during the war, and which contributed principally to the favorable issue of it.
Okay, he's actually saying, hey, let's not, you know, forget that the only reason we're here is because the common people took up arms to fight that war. The only reason we're here is because of them. Because they, all of these guys, these heady guys, they were the aristocracy. They were the ones in the cushy chambers that weren't taking bullets and so forth, right? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and somehow they're able to keep their spirits up.
Yep.
He related the honorable refusal of the American seamen who were carried in great numbers into the British prisons during the war to redeem themselves from misery or to seek their fortunes by entering on board the ships of the enemies to their country.
Right.
Contrasting their patriotism with a contemporary instance in which the British seamen made prisoners by the Americans readily entered on the ships of the latter, of being promised a share of the prizes that might be made in their own country.
Ah, and so they were corrupting them, saying, you know, if you want to come along, whatever we take, you can get a part of. In other words, if you look at the Navy back then, it was far more piracy than it was, you know, legitimate, you know, government functioning and that type of stuff. So, as a matter of fact, when you really look at the way the Navy and the Marine Corps was set up, their first objective was to steal as many British ships as they could to create the Navy, because when they started off, they were actually using private ships that were being donated by gracious, you know, ship owners. You know, like today, these multi-yachts and so forth. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I can kind of see how tempting it might be to reward yourself because these guys were basically just, deckhands. They were bosun's mates. They were just guys that labored on a ship. And actually, the technology of sailing in those days was pretty simple. I mean, it wasn't the implementation of steam or, nuclear physics. So today technology is really, to have a naval ship, you've got to really understand a lot of different components and pieces to design, operate by yourself, let alone with a crew. So anyhow, I think what Franklin is bringing up is the fact that, we need to ensure a way, and I've always been an advocate. At least I'd like to think I've always been an advocate that the common person should actually have representation in, whatever form of government, at the local form and at the state. In other words, in the House of Representatives, as long as the powers that are being delegated are not specific enough, or what I mean by that is nothing that actually is serving the individuals. In other words, these are not general powers. They are specific and limited powers, but they're relative to the serving of the general society. In other words, not bringing jobs to a county, not bringing jobs into your local area where, I've made this deal and we're bringing this guy in here. That should not be happening. The federal government should not be basically brokering deals. And the reason that they're able to do this today is really because we have ignored the Constitution to a point. And as a matter of fact, I know you listen to every one of my shows, but you may not have actually heard my show last Friday where I talked in detail about the tariffs and how I, out of one side of my mouth, I say, hey, or not. I'm not trying to say I'm being fork-tongued, but the point is that there is some good with what Trump is doing, some legitimate good, but on the other hand, he's doing just as bad in violating the Constitution as Reagan and the rest of the globalists, because most people don't even look at Reagan as a globalist. Now, you might be old enough to know that prior to the 1980s, U.S. manufacturers could not actually go overseas and start producing products and be immune to, the tariffs or imposts bringing that product back into America. In other words, global corporations were not, the stage had not been set and the walls had not been broken down, the constitutional barriers to allow, IBM and all of these big global companies to operate outside the United States. the first barrier that the Constitution had to actually, or I should say the federal government and Constitution and state government had to knock down, was allowing corporations to operate with immunity across state lines. There's nowhere in the Constitution that allows the federal government to create standard regulations for corporations so that they immune themselves from the state's desires and needs of how they want to manage their businesses. Does that make sense? And so they had to break those barriers, and some of those things that they actually started doing was towards the mid to the late 1800s. I fondly think of how Procter & Gamble has been around a long time. And Procter & Gamble, when they were fighting the concepts of union just to maintain competitiveness, just to maintain, a moniker of, I'll just say, a rational price for what they're doing and a level of control over their brand. And so they saw the unions coming in, and basically if a union comes in, what it does is it creates a hostile relationship with the host. And the best thing that any host or any manufacturer, anybody that is doing business, the best thing you can do is you have a symbiotic relationship with all your employees. So very few people know this, but Procter & Gamble actually started doing profit sharing with their employees, or they offered profit sharing with their employees, and many employees just passed it up. Many employees didn't recognize, the benefits or anything like that. They just wanted the concept of a union so that they wouldn't have to, put 100% every day of the week, that they would have this commonality that everybody would produce the same amount of widgets a day. And they would come up with what that standard is. And that standard is always lower than what would happen if everybody was actually, forced to compete with each other. In other words, taking away the rewards of those who can do it faster, do it better, and so forth. And then, punishing those people that can actually do well, and then spreading the gloom upon all people, because bottom line, the union took away the merit system. It took away the rewards of actually, working and working hard and working efficient and improving your efficacies and so forth. So the point here is that here Procter & Gamble tried their best to keep the unions out, and the people would rather have a low standard than more money. Do you think that's odd?
That is. Yeah, that's funny.
You think that's odd? Interestingly enough, there have been plenty of surveys over the course of the past couple centuries regarding labor, I should say, over the past century plus. And there have been laborers, and it seems like there's this commonality that most laborers literally have the paradigm that they just want to have a job where they can enjoy life and enjoy their family and not have a lot of responsibility. They're not looking for promotion. They're not looking to basically climb the corporate ladder. They're not looking to compete. They're just looking to have the job as their nest egg, or their security web, their blanket of security and or safety net. Let's use that. And so the majority of Americans, unfortunately, have adopted that paradigm because, the chances of you getting ahead to becoming, promoted and up that chain, most people, I guess they're more pragmatic, right? Because What are the odds? What are the odds of a high school player, high school kid who has all this ambition, right? It's an ambition that drives them. And they go, you know what? If I'm really good in baseball, I'm really good in basketball, I'm really good in football, I can go to the show. You know what the show means, right? Going to the big leagues, the pros, and become a, you know, get one of these big, you know, money paying contracts. Wow, I could be rich. But what are the odds out of all the kids playing in high school going to college? And what are the odds of all the kids in college making it to the pros? I mean, when you count how many seats, how many butts are in the seats of all the teams in the NBA, all the teams of the NFL, all the, I mean, every year there's going to be a whole bunch of kids that will not make the cut. And so by this point in time, when people are now, you know, of the age working as an employee, they realize that there's always going to be something that will not, you know, allow them to advance. Most people start realizing this, and they just accept their fate. Is that not a sad indictment? It is. So anyway, I apologize for going down this long path, but here's Benjamin Franklin kind of pointing out that we need to not, you know, just ignore these guys. And so let's pick up where you kind of left off, which was down after might be made by their own country. So go ahead.
Yep. This proceeded, he said, from the different manner in which the common people were treated in America and Great Britain. He did not think that the elected had any right in any case to narrow the privileges of the electors. He quoted as arbitrary the British statute setting forth the danger of tumultuous meetings, and under that pretext narrowing the right of suffrage to persons having freeholds of a certain value, observing that this statute was soon followed by another under the succeeding parliamentarian, subjecting the people who had no votes to peculiar labors and hardships. He was persuaded also that such a restriction as was proposed would give great uneasiness in the populous states. The sons of the substantial farmer, not being themselves freeholders, would not be pleased at being disenfranchised, and there are a great many persons of the description.
Okay. So, wow, what a big piece, what a golden nugget he threw out there. That we needed, they needed to be very cognitive of not creating a system that would create or open the doors of oppression towards those people who wouldn't be eligible, to ensure that representation was had for all, whether they wanted it or not, whether they whether they cherished it or not. So now we're going to go down, folks. We're going to actually go into the next day, August 8th, and we're going to go a ways down, and we're talking getting down to property, where we're on something like page 271. And the reason you see so many names is there's probably a bunch of moves and motions and votes here, votes there. So you, by all means, go through this, and you can see how things kind of, you know, slowly started taking form. But by this point in time, the Constitution, August 8th, the Constitution was actually taking form. In other words, the articles were being pounded out. And it's just amazing how they were capable of, you know, deducing and working from basic resolutions that we need to do this, we need to do this. And then they started filling in the blanks. So let's go ahead with Governor Morris's comment regarding property.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to insert free before the word inhabitants. Much, he said, would depend on this point. He never would concur in upholding domestic slavery. It was a nefarious institution. It was the curse of heaven on the states where it prevailed. Compare the free regions of the middle states, where a rich and noble cultivation marks the prosperity and happiness of the people, with the misery and poverty which overspread the barren wastes of Virginia, Maryland, and other states having slaves.
Okay, so right here, he's kind of setting the stage for where Mason actually goes a little bit further, calling every slave owner a petty tyrant and so forth on August 22nd. So this is kind of preceding that, but Mason wasn't the only one that was recognizing this importance of separating. That's because that's what he started off with. He wanted to move to insert free before the word inhabitants. So in other words, representation was going to be guaranteed to the free inhabitants, not to slaves. Because they wanted to differentiate this. So go ahead. Go ahead.
Travel through the whole continent and you behold the prospect continually varying with the appearance and disappearance of slavery. The moment you leave the eastern states and enter New York, the effects of the institution become visible. Passing through the Jerseys and entering Pennsylvania, every criterion of superior improvement witnesses the change. Proceed southwardly, and every step you take through the great region of slaves presents a duster increasing with the increasing proportion of these wretched beings.
Yeah, so
on what principle?
So what he was saying there was, through the great region of slaves presents a desert increasing with the increasing proportion of these wretched beings. So anyway, I just wanted to, because I think you, some of these things like presence and presents. So anyway, right. Okay, go ahead.
Upon what principle is it that the slave shall be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Are they property? Why then is no other property included? The house in this city, Philadelphia, are worth more than all the wretched slaves which cover the rice swamps of South Carolina. The admission of slaves into the representation, when fairly explained, comes to this, that the inhabitant of Georgia and South Carolina who goes to the coasts of Africa and in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity tears away his fellow creatures from their dearest connections and damns them to the most cruel bondages shall have more votes in government instituted for protection of the rights of mankind than the citizen of Pennsylvania or New Jersey who views with a laudable horror so nefarious a practice. He would add that domestic slavery is the most prominent feature of the aristocratic countenance of the proposed Constitution.
Yep.
The vassalage of the poor has ever been the favorite offspring of aristocracy. What is the proposed compensation to the northern states for a sacrifice of every principle of right, of every impulse of humanity? They are to bind themselves to march their militia for the defense of the southern states, for their defense against those very slaves whom they complain. We must supply vessels and seamen in case of foreign attack. The legislature will have indefinite power to tax them by excises and duties on imports, both of which will fall heavier on them than on the southern inhabitants. I don't know what that word is for the Lahiti used by the northern freemen will pay more tax than the whole consumption of the miserable slave, which consists of nothing more than his physical substance and the rag that covers his nakedness. On the other side, the southern states are not to be restrained from importing fresh supplies of wretched Africans at once to increase the danger of attack and the difficulty of defense. Nay, they are to be encouraged to it by assurance of having their votes in the national government increased in proportion, and are at the same time to have their exports and their slaves exempt from all the contributions for the public service. Let it not be said that direct taxation is to be proportioned to representation. It is idle to suppose that the general government can stretch its hand directly into the pockets of the people scattered over so vast a country. They can only do it through the medium of exports, imports, and excises. For what, then, are all these sacrifices to be made? He would sooner submit himself to a tax for paying for all of the Negroes in the U.S., then saddle posterity with such a constitution.
Ah, interesting. So, a lot of really good points right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Dayton of New Jersey then seconded the motion. He said that his sentiments on the subject might appear whatever might be the fate of the amendment. Now, Mr. Sherman of Connecticut, now all of these are northern states where they have this disdain for slavery. Mr. Sherman did not regard the admission of Negroes into the ratio of representation as liable to such insuperable objections. It was the freemen of the southern states who were in fact to be represented according to the taxes paid by them, and the Negroes are only included in the estimate of the taxes. This was his idea of the matter. Now, all of a sudden, the Southerners step up, and Mr. Pinckney says he considered the fisheries and the western frontier as more burdensome to the U.S. than the slaves. He thought this could be demonstrated if the occasion were a proper one. Mr. Wilson, so this is how they're going back and forth. And Mr. Wilson thought that the motion premature, an agreement to the clause, would be no bar to the object of it. Question on motion to insert free before inhabitants. New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, no. And actually, Pennsylvania was where Governor Morris was from. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. And all the rest of the states, no. So the only state that actually got it across the finish line was Delaware. On the suggestion of Mr. Dickinson, the words, quote, provided that each state shall have one representative at least, close quote, were added without any contention. They were unanimously accepted. That's where it started right there. That language of moving from, you know, this concept of freeholding land or what have you, provided that each state shall have one representative at least. So they wanted to make sure that every state had at least one representative, just like Wyoming has one representative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then Article 4, Section 4, as amended, was agreed. So they're basically going through these different parts of the articles. Like I said, this is where you can see the Constitution was actually forming. They talked about these specific sections within the Articles of the Constitution. Okay. So now we slide and slide and slide down to foreign and immigrants. There's just one paragraph that Mr. Butler makes, and this is on Thursday, August 9th. It's a ways down. Actually, it's not that far down page-wise because it's page 279. It's blue. And while you're getting there, because what we're going to actually do is we're going to dive into properties and umpires and so forth on August 10th after we take a quick look at a little bit of electors. But let me just read this. This is Mr. Butler, and I believe he was from South Carolina, was decidedly opposed to the admission of foreigners without a long residence in the country. They bring with them not only attachments to their other countries, but ideas of government so distinct from ours that in every point of view, they are dangerous. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very.
Okay. So, in other words, states should actually have some reservations of allowing somebody that just moves there from another state to be just become a citizen of their state with full access and full voting power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because, unfortunately, they created a free market of ideas and a free market of moving, reciprocity, and all of that. But anyway, let me go on. He acknowledged that if he himself had been called into public life within a short time after coming to America, his foreign habits, opinions, and attachments would have rendered him an improper agent in public affairs. He mentioned the great strictness observed in Great Britain on this particular subject. Now, just bringing up Great Britain would just probably cause people to become contrarians and say, yeah, we want to do the exact opposite. Anyway, so if you jump down, I don't know if you saw it already, but Mr. Madison makes a comment regarding electors, and this is on page 282. And if you want to pick that one up, there you go.
Okay. Mr. Madison, the necessity of a general government supposes that the state legislatures will sometimes fail or refuse to consult the common interest at the expense of their local conveniency or prejudices. Policy of referring the appointment of the House of Representatives to the people and not to the legislatures of the state supposes that the result will be somewhat influenced by the mode. This view of the question seems to decide that the legislatures of the states ought not to have the uncontrolled right of regulating the times, places, and manner of holding elections. These were words of great latitude. It was impossible to foresee all the abuses that might be made of the discretionary power. Whether the elector should vote by ballot or viva voce, is that how you say that?
By voice, yeah, by voice.
Oh, by voice. Should assemble at this place or that place, should be divided into districts, or all meet at one place, should all vote for all the representatives, or all in a district vote for a number allotted to the district. These and many other points would depend on the legislatures and might materially affect the appointments. Whenever the state legislatures had a favorite measure to carry, they would take care so to mold their regulations as to favor the candidates they wished to succeed. Besides, the inequality of the representation in the legislatures of particular states would produce a like inequality in the representation in the national legislature, as it was presumable that the counties, having the power in the former case, would secure it to themselves in the latter. What danger could there be in giving a controlling power to the national legislature? Of whom was it to consist? One, of a Senate to be chosen by the state legislatures. If the latter, therefore, could be trusted, the representatives could not be dangerous. Two, of the representatives elected by the same people who elect the state legislatures. Surely, then, if confidence is due to the latter, it must be due to the former. It seemed as improper in principle, though it might be less inconvenient in practice, to give to the state legislatures the great authority over the election of the representatives of the people and the general legislature, as it would be to give to the latter a like power over the election of the representatives in the state legislatures.
Okay, so he's kind of pointing to this. When we look at, you know, this, because they were arguing a danger between having the state legislature appoint the senators and not the people, and then that the people actually appoint the state legislatures. So in other words, there was an argument to have a direct or have more of a democracy where the people would choose both the Senate and the people would choose both the representative. And Madison was basically saying that, what's the difference? I mean, the people had chosen those state legislators, so if they're not happy with how they voted for the Senate, then they should be able to change their votes or change their representation in the state legislature. Hold them accountable. That right there became, I think, the bane of the existence of the Constitution, because they didn't have a mechanism, teeth, to hold public servants accountable. They had the oath, and they had the honor and the integrity of the individuals, but they did not have the direct ability to say, you can no longer be a public servant because you have violated your oath. That's what the 14th Amendment brought to the table. And this was the problem that many of these people started talking about, that even Madison was saying, well, it doesn't equate based on why you're saying it, but that was because they had a different paradigm. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.